And I want to start this morning with a poem. I don't usually start with poems, but I want to start today with a poem. And it simply reads like this. It's kind of telling a story. So I guess if there are poems that I like, that's the sort of thing I would prefer. So this one tells a story. 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it was scarcely worth his while to waste much time in an old violin, but held it up with a smile. "What am I bidding, good folks?" he cried. "Who'll start the bidding for me? A pound, then two, only two? 2 pounds. And who'll make it three? 3 pounds once, 3 pounds twice, going for three, but no." From the room far back, a grey-haired man came forward and picked up the bow, then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightened the loosened strings. He played a melody pure and sweet as a carolling angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quite quiet and low, said, "What am I bid for the old violin?" And he held it up with the bow. "£1,000? Who'll make it two? 2,000? Who'll make it three? 3,000 once, 3,000 twice, and going, gone." The people cheered, but some of them cried. "We do not quite understand what changed its worth." Swift came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. Well, this morning we're going to continue our series on revival, renewal and reshaping. And to be honest, we're coming to a passage where Israel, the people of God, are really very much at rock bottom. They're like that old violin that's battered and broken, stuffed in a cupboard that nobody really wants anymore, with the strings all pretty well hanging loose and way out of tune. And maybe for us, we are also maybe a little bit like that. Maybe not quite so broken up. Perhaps we are. Strings all rather loose and out of tune, out of kilter. And maybe not where God would want us to be. Maybe not where we want to be. Maybe there's a whole cloud over us. As you'll have gathered from the reading that David brought to us, we are in 1 Samuel 7. And here the people are at a place where they really need a completely fresh sheet. They need a fresh start. Things have really, really wound down from them. Let me give you the background for the story. We are entering this story at 1 Samuel 7 and verse 2. But prior to this, if you were to take the story back to chapter 4, and in a sense this is a unit from chapter 4 through to the end of this chapter is a unit, because we know that really, because the place that the chapter starts where this unit starts at is a place called Ebenezer, where they experience a huge defeat, a massive, massive defeat. And the precious violin, if you like, the precious thing that the Israelites have, the Ark of God, gets taken away into captivity. But now, at the end of the story, as we'll see, there is another thing called Ebenezer. Once again, they're like sort of bookends, really, for this whole section. And of course, it is a massive turn around that we see through these four or so chapters. So yes, the ark was taken away, but then it returned. The Philistines didn't want it. It caused amazing trouble. They didn't want it. They got rid of it. It came back into the land of Israel, a place called Beth Shemesh. And there, unfortunately, some of the Israelites looked into the ark. They didn't treat it as holy. They were struck down. And so the people of Beth Shemesh said to the folks at Kiriath Jearim, "Why don't you come up, take the box, the ark, away?" They did that, and they removed it to Abinadab's house. And there, Eliezer, his son, is, if you like, the priest. He looks after that ark there. And that house knows God's blessing for the whole time that ark is there. But that ark, essentially, is pretty marooned, really. It's parked. And maybe your Christian life could be described as parked someplace. And that's what was happening in that at that particular time. And it says there at the start of the chapter, where we started reading it, it was a long time. 20 years. And you get the whole sense, don't you, that everything is in a bad way. And the people are starting to really feel it. They're starting to mourn and to grieve. Today what I want to do is I want to just take us really through that process. I want us to imagine that in a sense we're watching that master violinist come along, and he takes the violin, he brushes it down, and he takes all the strings and he tightens them up. I still have my violin. I could have brought it this morning as an illustration. He tightens all the strings up one by one, gets them in tune, and then he begins to play on that violin. And what I want us to do is to take, if you like, four strings. Each of the strings, there are four strings in a violin, each of the strings, and to see how he tunes them up. To look at four stages to a place where this violin will once again be worth a lot of money. Verse 2 reads then, and the first string is that string of mourning. It was a long time, 20 years, in all that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim, and all the people of Israel mourned and sought after the Lord. And it's not just time, it's enough time. Some scientists want us to believe that time can achieve anything. As long as you've got enough of it, anything can really happen. Of course, I don't believe that for a moment. And they do say, don't they, that time is a good healer. Just give it time, the person will get over something, and very often, you know, time does help us. And here, there was a long time, but it was a very unpleasant time, very uncomfortable time, not a time that they were enjoying. And I think sometimes God uses leanness, to lean on us. Leanness to lean on us. And I think that's what's been happening here. There's been a lot of recent government initiatives, and one of them you've probably heard on the radio, on television, online, has been the cancer campaign. They've been talking about sort of bowel cancer, lung cancer, and their sort of catchphrase has been "Be clear on cancer." And it's all about awareness, isn't it? At the end of the day, that's what they're trying to do. Just raise the awareness, get people thinking about the issue, and maybe that will start to prompt people to do things. And here God wants to raise their awareness. He wants them to really start feeling their loss. And that is what's happening for them. It's kind of a prolonged misery. And God is very powerful in using that misery. Israel mourned and sought after the Lord. It's having its proper effect. I mean, it's not that mourning or being sad in and of itself is particularly useful. God isn't sort of promoting, if you're a sad and sorrowful person, therefore you're a much more blessed person. He's not saying if you are poor or in poverty, that is necessarily in and of itself good. It's not really. Just because we get in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, or blessed are those who mourn, those are spiritual states. Blessed are those who are poor in their spirit, those who know that they are bankrupt, those who know that they are at rock bottom. That's a good place, when you realise, I don't have anything, I need God. That's a good place to be. It's the starting point. That's why the Beatitudes, or 8 of them, start there. Blessed are the poor in spirit, because they realise their need. Blessed are those who mourn. That's the next one. Mourn because of what? Because of their sin, because of their sorrowful state. They look at the state and they go, wow, this is a dreadful state that I'm in. They say, don't they, that you can't save somebody unless you get them lost first. You need to enable somebody to realise their lostness. That's why we do talk not merely about God's love, we talk about him as a wrathful and a just God. And therefore, that means they're in a deep situation of problem, that they need to be rescued. Otherwise, judgment is absolutely certainly coming. And they won't be rejoicing when the Son of Man comes in the clouds on that for his second return. He's going to bring judgment. In his first coming, he brought and established salvation. But then he's going to come to take his own home, and also to bring judgment to all those that are not in Christ, not linked to Christ. So I wonder this morning, where are we? We have to ask ourselves that always, don't we? Whenever we read a passage, we have to put ourselves into the passage, put ourselves into the picture. We're not really any different from the people of God back then. We are the same ones. Maybe for us, the ark, the precious things of God are elsewhere. You know, many miles away from where they're meant to be. Just parked in some domestic dwelling. That's not really the place they should have been. David later on sort of lamented this thing, and he desired to bring it up. In fact, that ark was going to stay there a long time. It's going to stay there 100 years. David was the one who was finally going to bring it up to Jerusalem, and even that took 2 attempts to do it properly. Sadly, David didn't learn the history well enough. If he'd thought about why did it ever end up, you know, at Abinadab's house in the first place, he would have remembered the way that the people of Beth Shemesh mishandled the ark, mishandled the precious things of God. That's why it ended up there. Unfortunately, he went ahead to mishandle it again, didn't take it up to Jerusalem in the right way, put it on a cart. Bad idea when the cart stumbled and Uzzah got struck down for his irreverence. However, we must place ourselves into these situations as well, and maybe we also know a lot of being broken down. Maybe we are spiritually bone dry. We need to say and confess it to the Lord, that reality. No point covering it over. God sees everything. So this is the starting point. It's an unavoidable starting point. And maybe for us, God will be saying to us individually, maybe as a whole church, look, realize where you are. You know, realize you're dry. You're bone dry. And you need to start to mourn and grieve and groan and therefore begin to seek God's face again, to cry out to God. So that's the first string that is retightened by the master, master virtuoso. The second is that of moving. Once you start to mourn, then that opens a way to move and to change. Verses 3 and 4 become read in this way. It says, "And Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, if you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then rid yourselves of the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths, and commit yourself to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So the Israelites put away their Baals and Ashtoreths and served the Lord only." It's worth just noting that this section here, talking about the foreign gods, or the Baals and the Ashtoreths, the Baals there, that it's all in the plural, which just reminds us that they didn't just have one particular thing on the side. They had a whole collection that really represented, no doubt, all the different nations with whom they were kind of mixing and overlapping with. There were lots and lots of Baals. Baal just means master or lord with a small L. That's all it means, really. The different nations had their own masters, lords, gods with a little g. And they were starting to use all these different Baals and Ashtoreths, those that were, if you like, the female deities. Notice too that here it says serve the Lord. This is what Samuel says, serve the Lord only. Can you do that? Serve the Lord only? That's what Samuel is asking for here. I want to underline a number of things that are being asked for here that are part of this movement that goes on. And the first of all, the first one is it's a return. It's a return to the Lord. It's a reverse back. Imagine you're knitting a jumper. This will probably be hard for most of us here. Well, maybe not. Some of us can knit jumpers. But anyway, imagine you were knitting a jumper, and you know, you miss a few stitches and you go a number of rows, and then you realise, you look down and you think, oh dear, whoops, missed over a whole section. What do you do? I guess, and I don't know a lot about knitting, I guess you really just have to unpick, go back to that point you went wrong and start from there. And it's the same thing, isn't it, with God. When we start to hear him and hear him pinpointing things and saying, you know, look down at your life, you know, you've gone wrong some way back, you do have to go back to that point, to reverse back and to put right what was wrong. And of course that was what God said to the church at Ephesus. You know, you have forsaken your first love, you know, go back and do what you did at the beginning, retrace to there, go back to that point, start to warm up from where you went wrong. You've lost your love for me. You need to find it again. You need to love me again. Go back there. So that's the first thing, a return. Then it's a riddance, isn't it? He says, get rid, rid yourselves of the foreign gods. They were just copying what other people around them did. And it was like, for them, excess baggage. If you're going to go on a flight, on a long journey, you know, excess baggage is everybody's nightmare, isn't it? You get there, you put them on the scales, you've got 23 kilograms, it's 24.9. They don't normally go, oh, that's fine, don't worry about it. They go, it's too heavy. Would you like to pay excess baggage? It'll just cost you, you know, £100, and you're kind of like, well, it's about the same price as my ticket. You don't tend to do excess baggage unless you're really desperate. It's not what you do. It's way too expensive. And we, as Christians, should know that our excess baggage is way too expensive for us. It's way too costly. We have to get shot of our extra baggage in our lives. And of course, there's passages that talk exactly about this sort of thing. Running the race. There is a race marked out for us. And if you're on it, you can't take excess baggage with you. It's hard, because we all want to. We all want to have our different things. But this is what Hebrews 12 says. It says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. The verse prior to that talks of this race. It says, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Throw off everything that hinders. We'll be seeing that in the Olympics, won't we? They all come to the race, and there's nothing extra there, is there? No extra fat, but no extra baggage. Nothing kind of flapping along behind them that's going to weigh them down. Everything is pared down to the minimum. We find that such a hard lesson to learn, don't we, as Christians? We really find that very difficult, not to be carrying all sorts of other stuff along with us. It really does hold us back so much. And we need to look at our lives and see, well, what am I carrying? What am I trying to carry along that God's always saying, always shaking his head about, saying, no, no, you really shouldn't be taking that along. Don't take that along. You know, you won't get through the gate with that stuff. You're way overweight. Thirdly, it's got to be something radical. Serve the Lord only. They could not be half-hearted, half measures, half-baked. It was to be thoroughgoing for them. It had to be radical. And also, fourthly, it had to be without reserve. They had to commit themselves. We don't like committing, do we? You know, if you try and sort of nail somebody down, we can often be like jelly. You say, you know, I need you to commit to this. People are kind of like, well, you know, can't I keep it open? Can't we keep this open? And God says, well, you need to commit yourself to this. Can we not commit to God? Can we not say, Lord, I am committed. I won't be flexible on this because it's you. You asked me to be for you alone, without reserve, the Lord only. And I will commit to that. So the first thing is, they begin to mourn. And time has essentially brought that on. Misery has brought that on. Then, after that, they begin to move. And it starts privately, doesn't it? Not really. It starts inside, privately, personally, on our own, usually in our quiet place. Maybe we, that sort of a closet place we go to, that secret corner where we're on our own. Maybe as we drive along, we talk to God. Maybe as we walk along. It can be any place. That's where it begins. But after that, after mourning, after moving, there is maintaining. That's the third string. And in a sense, this is where it moves from the private into the public domain. This is, in a sense, where things need to come out. We need to out ourselves. There needs to be a public counterpart to the private aspect of things. Let's see how that comes out, verses 5 and 6. Then Samuel said, assemble all Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with the Lord for you. When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted, and there they confessed, we have sinned against the Lord. So things are coming out into the open, and here, in a sense, they're taking a more accountable stance. That's what happens, in a sense. When you bring something and make something public, then you're letting other people know about it. You're putting yourself into the public, into the sort of public scrutiny, public gaze. And there are three things that are there, in a sense, on their part, and a couple of things that I want to draw out, which Samuel does in this kind of public arena. The first is that they stop hiding, and they expose themselves. They don't name it and claim it, but they name it and shame it. We have sinned. And they come out and declare that. The second thing they do is that they fast. There's actually not a lot of fasting commanded or sort of enshrined in the Old Testament. There's lots of sacrifices. Really, I think only on the Day of Atonement is where we find a day of fasting or denying yourselves. That's the way it's put in Leviticus 16, denying yourselves. So that's what they do. And in a sense, it's a mark of the seriousness of their situation. They want to mark that this is serious, and therefore they will deny themselves. It's not there isn't any denying of ourselves as Christians in New Testament. You know, Jesus says, you know, deny yourselves, take up your cross daily. So it does have a facet of our Christian lives that we should deny ourselves. But then they do something very interesting. They pour out water before the Lord. Now I wonder what does that mean, pouring out water before the Lord? There's not a lot of other places we see that, to be honest. So it's pretty unique. However, there are a few passages which give us an idea of perhaps what it's to do with. Lamentation is one of them. This is a book that comes after Jeremiah. And this is where Jeremiah himself writes a number of laments. I want to just read Lamentation 2, 18 and 19. It says, "The hearts of the people cry out to the Lord. O wail, daughter of Zion, let your tears flow like a river day and night, and give yourself no relief, your eyes no rest. Arise, cry out in the night as the watches of the night begin. Pour out your heart like water." You can see the sort of thing there. It's sort of in this whole area of distress and really just pouring out everything to the Lord. Psalm 22 is another example. This is a messianic psalm. Covers aspects of the crucifixion. And I want to just read a couple of verses there. Psalm 22, 12, 13 and 14. It says, "Many bulls surround me, strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions tearing their prey open their mouths wide against me. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted away within me. I am poured out like water." Jesus, that's a picture of Jesus on the cross, how he felt completely sort of emptied. And so I guess it's got this picture, it's sort of picturing the fact that they feel emptied. They want to pour themselves out. They're recognizing really their distress. Perhaps in a sense it has the idea that they are at a place where they feel very wasted. Like water, if I take this cup of water and I pour it on the ground, I can't drink it anymore. It's gone, really. It's useless. You can't really reclaim it. And I think that's partly what they're saying. So it acknowledges the seriousness of things, how much they are like that. They are desperate. They are poured out. They need to be remade. What about Samuel's part? If Moses was known for the law, and if Jeremiah was known as the weeping prophet, if Job was known for his patience, what would Samuel be known for? Well, I guess he would be known as a man of prayer, as a real intercessor. Psalm 99 verse 6 says, "Moses and Aaron were among his priests. Samuel was among those who called on his name." Jeremiah 15 verse 1, "The Lord said to me, even if Moses and Samuel were to stand before me, my heart would not go out to this people. So obviously the picture is there that they will stand before the Lord and pray on behalf of the people, and God simply saying no. I wouldn't even listen to Moses or Samuel. I mean, Moses was a great intercessor, as we saw last week. He was the one that stood in the gap after the golden calf episode. You know, that great guilt and shame and that great glory that Moses asked for. And how did it happen? Well, because of his intercession. Because of God's great grace that he slowly drew out and teased out prayers from Moses. So this is the first thing, that Samuel prays. That's his part, isn't it? And you see it in verse 5. He says there, "Assemble all Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with the Lord for you." Verse 8, they said to Samuel, "Do not stop crying out to the Lord for us." Verse 9, he cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him. He was a great prayer. And it's... I think it's worth marking at this point, as we're thinking about revival, that there will be no revival anywhere of whatever scale or magnitude unless there is prayer. That's absolutely vital, isn't it? And maybe that's an area we as a church need to think about. Could we be described as a church after Samuel's legacy? Could we be described as a church that is big on intercession, big on prayer? I'm not sure that we could, really. Maybe that's something we really need to think through. But notice the second thing that Samuel does, and it comes there in verse 9, and it's another rather unusual thing, and it might well be something that we don't notice the significance of it. It says, "Then Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord." Now, there's at least a couple of things there. First thing is, obviously, this is a burnt offering. A burnt offering was a whole offering. In a sense, it spoke of giving everything to the Lord. And it was a voluntary offering. Well, the more interesting thing is this suckling lamb. What does that mean? Well, Leviticus 22:27 talks about the fact that there are certain animals that you can use, suckling animals, either a calf, a lamb, a goat, and they have to stay with their mother for 7 days. And then on the 8th day, they can be used as a suckling offering. Now, what is the significance of the 8th day? The number 8. The dedication of the firstborn, where a firstborn will be circumcised if it's male, is on the 8th day. Jesus was taken up to the temple, wasn't he? He was dedicated. The dedication of the temple itself was done in Solomon's Day on the 8th day, the day after the Sabbath. The cleansing from ritual uncleanness. Now that took place using special cleansing water, using the ashes of a heifer and all that sort of thing. This was done on the 8th day. The inauguration of the priesthood, Aaron and his sons, done on the 8th day. Jesus' resurrection. I know we talk about the first day of the week. Well, what is that? Well, it is, yes, the 8th day. So what is the relevance of the 8th day? Well, I think it speaks very much of a new start, a new beginning. Being cleansed, being purified from your sin, it's a new start. Wiping the slate clean again. Inaugurating the priesthood, it's a fresh beginning. A new day is dawning. A new thing is coming to pass. Jesus' resurrection, a new thing is being done. The firstborn. Circumcision was the sign of the covenant. It was a new standing, in a sense, that they had. It's very curious, isn't it, this number 8, this 8th day. And so the Samuel takes a suckling lamb, one that would have been only available from the 8th day, and he offers that up. I think Samuel is using that very deliberately to indicate, here we are, Lord, we are making a fresh start for, you know, in this situation. This is the appropriate offering. To say we need cleansing, our slate needs to be cleansed, our strings need to be tightened up, and this is the place that we find ourselves. So thus far, a mourning, which is necessary to get things started, then a moving in private, that's where it really begins, for ourselves. We alone know ourselves, apart from God. We alone can look in our hearts and know how hot, medium, or totally cold we are. And then after that, a maintaining. How can this really go on? You can start the process, but only get so far through it. How can you maintain the process? Well, one of the ways is to bring it out of the private realm and to make it more public, in a sense. And this is what happens here with the people. They come out in public and they go through a ceremony that really marks it and states things. They allow themselves to become accountable, and then the appropriate things are made, offerings are made, and that's good. But there is a final thing, and that is what I'm calling a marking. A mourning, a moving, a maintaining, and a marking. And this is, in a sense, the most obvious part of the passage. This is the part that people would always think of. If you're going to preach on 1 Samuel 7, oh, well, that's the Ebenezer passage. You'll be preaching on Ebenezer. Well, it is at the end of the passage, we should note. In this passage, there's a number of actors, if you want to call it that, people that are playing a part. Obviously, the people, that is one set of actors, who are repenting and confessing and changing. And then you've got Samuel, who's very instrumental in the whole thing. And he's instrumental at a number of levels. He's a prophet. That's very key, isn't it? Notice that right at the start of things, he says, you know, if you are returning, then do it the right way. You know, you need to make sure you aren't just coming in for a short sort of, oh yes, I repent of my sins and all of that sort of stuff. And it's not really true. So Samuel's acting as a prophet. He calls people to real action. He nails things for people. That's what prophets do, you know. That's what preachers do. They seek to nail things as they understand them. He's also a priest. He intercedes. He stands in the gap for the people. He offers sacrifices on behalf of the people. But he's also, to some extent, a king as well, in the sense that he's a judge. This passage tells us at the end that he's a judge. And what that means is he's really the leader at that time. This is pre-monarchy. There's no kings at this stage. But he's acting like a king. He's a sort of political leader for the Israelites. And of course we have the Lord Jesus Christ, who fulfills all those roles so much better than a Samuel ever could. He is our prophet. He is our high priest. He is our eternal king. Most key of all, of course, is the Lord, who takes action in this situation. He is the one that thunders from heaven. He is the one ultimately that brings the victory for us. You know, I'm not suggesting that we enter into and embark on a sort of a self-improvement program. I'm not trying to give you a how to sort yourself out sort of a sermon. We need the Lord in these things. He is the one that has the real strength, that really can start to change. He's the master tuner, isn't he? But we need to be aware and to work with the Lord, to allow ourselves to be tuned up, not to resist him, but to go with his work with us, to allow him to play a tune in our lives. So we come to this stone, Ebenezer. That's literally what it means, Eben, and is a stone of help. Verse 12, then Samuel took a stone, set it up between Mizra and Shen, and named it Ebenezer, saying, thus far has the Lord helped us. That's the interpretation of it. It's not the literal meaning. It's the interpretation of kind of its significance. So the English Standard Version puts it like this: till now, the Lord has helped us. The New Century Bible puts it this way: the Lord has helped us up until this point. How very necessary it is for us to mark things, to mark points in our life. Now, why? Why do you need to mark things? Well, simply because you forget. You forget over time, very quickly, actually. It can only take a few months. You might have come to a very significant point in your life. 2 months down the line, it's pretty well you've forgotten it altogether. And then something will remind you and you think, oh, yeah, I suppose that did all happen then. I kind of completely forgot about the fact that the Lord spoke to me very powerfully on that occasion. I completely forgot that. So we need things to mark significant points, milestones in our life. That's what we need. This is what it kind of was, a milestone. To that particular mile, the Lord had helped them. And of course, we've got good examples of people like this. I think of people like Jacob. I mean, he wasn't perfect by any stretch of anybody's imagination. However, at the end of his life, he was able to testify about the Lord, who had been his God and led him all this way until that day. as he looked back, as he saw different milestones, places where God had definitely met him, and he had marked them in his own mind. Bethel, the God of Bethel, the house of God, where God came down on that ladder to heaven. Other points, he had marked them in his mind, and he knew, therefore, that God had been with him all the way through his life. In fact, so we need to do this as well. We need to follow this biblical pattern and to set up monuments to remind us of the monumental acts of God. So how do you do that? Well, there's lots of ways, I guess, but one of them is simply to note them down. I certainly do that. I have journals. I write things down. I note verses that have become key. I try to remind myself of the circumstances where God has gone into my life. I want to just end where I began, with a poem. And I didn't read actually all the poem. There was one verse I didn't read, and I'm going to read it now. And just for the sake of continuity, I'll read the last but one verse as well. This was the end of the poem. It says, the people cheered, but some of them cried. We did not quite understand what changed its worth, this violin. What changed its worth? Swift came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune and battered and scarred with sin is auctioned cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. I wonder whether we are going to be auctioned cheap, of little value, or whether we would be tuned up by the Lord, the master violinist, the master player. So let us go through this process of mourning, of moving, of maintaining, of marking these stages, these strings.